Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 1947 Powell and Pressburger film Black Narcissus. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Barrett, so this is our second Archer's film in a row. So it was interesting. We don't often do this where we watch two films from the same director or same directing team. But I think this is kind of interesting to think about these two films in conversation with each other, and also to think about this film in conversation with a lot of other things that we watched. As I was going through this, I just kept thinking of, oh, this makes me think of this other film. And like I feel like Black Narcissus, you could put in so many double features or so many series, and it's like, this has something to say about this other film.
Yeah, exactly. It's a film that's been highly esteemed for a number of years. I actually forgot, maybe you did, Sam, I forgot to check on where it landed or if it landed in the Sight and Sound poll.
It's in the kind of lower 100. So Powell and Pressburger have two films in the top 100, Matter of Life and Death and The Red Shoes, and then Black Narcissus falls just outside of that.
Yeah, it's a little surprising to me just because, it's a film that directors have been deeply influenced by, especially people trying to figure out how effectively they want to use color. And it has some immediate effects on films immediately following as well.
So what is your history with this film? Where did this fall into your experience with Powell and Pressburger?
It's been quite a while. In fact, I really can't clearly remember when I last saw it, because I remember the last time I kind of visited or revisited the Archers, I watched A Canterbury Tale, and I watched A Matter of Life and Death, and I watched The Red Shoes. And I had a vague recollection of having seen Black Narcissus years before, but this is the first time I've been back to it, as far as I can remember. So it really was a fresh experience.
It was interesting doing some of the reading and listening to some Criterion has a lot of good stuff on this as well. There's a commentary that's part Michael Powell, part Martin Scorsese, which is the Scorsese parts in particular are pretty interesting because he has a great deal of affection for the Archers and for Powell and for these films. But to hear people, and maybe even Scorsese, talked about originally seeing this film on television in black and white. And it's like, what a weird experience of this movie if you strip it away from that. So he talked about how like effective it still was, but then also how much of a revelation seeing this film in color. And he particularly talks about one viewing of it that he saw in 1983, and I forget where it was, but on the biggest screen you could possibly see it. And you know the scene where it like cuts to the really close up of the red pink flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Said that people had like a physical reaction to. He says like he according to him, even watching it on a pristine, Blu-ray copy on a great TV, he's like, it's great, but you don't understand it until you've seen it on the scale that he saw it there. He said like it's one of the most important moments of his life, color wise, to see that. So like that was pretty fascinating to hear someone like Scorsese say that.
Yeah, it really is interesting to think about, because I obviously grew up watching almost all of my films in black and white on TV. And it is interesting to think about the degree to which this film does rely on color. Yet at the same time, if I think about some of the composition of the film, some of the editing of the film, I could still see how it would have an impact on you, but certainly not to the same extent.
Absolutely. It's interesting to think about this film in conversation with A Matter of Life and Death, because they're made just 1 year apart. So this is 47, A Matter of Life and Death is 46. So they seem very different than each other. At the same time, I think there are definitely connections you can draw between them. This is a kind of a playing out of to a degree of some ideas that we see in A Matter of Life and Death. I think the big difference that jumped out at me was, we talked last week about how life-affirming A Matter of Life and Death is, and it's, partially why that film is made, coming out of World War II and thinking about kind of how do we rebuild the world after that and how do we think about Anglo-American relations. So it's this movie about kind of love and the possibilities of love to overcome the impossibilities, even to overcome death. And then you get this movie, which feels so much It's interesting that we're talking about color, but this movie, there's so much like interesting darkness on the edges of this movie that I don't feel as much in A Matter of Life and Death. I mean, this, if A Matter of Life and Death feels like a quintessentially 1946 movie, this feels like a quintessentially late 40s, early 50s movie. It's like, yep, now we're done with the like honeymoon of post-war. Now let's start to think about what the world looks like. And I just loved that.
Well, stylistically, by the end, it becomes a film noir, in a sense. And it's also a film that does kind of engage the outside world. Some people see it not exactly as an allegory, but as a kind of a farewell to India, the year before India gets its independence from Britain. It's also the first film that the Archers adopted from another work. It's adopted from Rumour Godden's novel. Which was about her experience growing up in India. So in that sense, it is a little bit of a, it's a, it, that's one way which it's a departure from Life and Death, and that they are actually relying on a different author. But at the same time, you're right. It's kind of taking us deeper into a darker post-war mood.
Well, I'm glad you brought up film noir because, like, this is not a film noir, but this sits so nicely alongside some of those things. Like, this is a movie about the things we see on the surface and the things bubbling beneath the surface. And I feel like film noir is a lot about, even when I said this has sort of darkness on the edges, like that's, I feel like part of film noir is like those darkness on the edges, and what if we keep picking at that darkness, and what are you potentially going to uncover? I feel like this movie is created clearly in the same world that's going to embrace film noir as a almost as a necessary piece of art, right? Like this is the questions we need to be asking. This is the things we need to be thinking about.
Well, I mean, Sister Ruth, it's not too far from this portrayal to a true film, femme fatale. She's obviously motivated by what in film noir they call the amour fou, the crazy love. And speaking of comparison to Life and Death, what a transformation from the heavenly angel who welcomed
Yes.
Bob into the afterlife to Sister Ruth. So Kathleen Byron was one of Powell's discoveries, and she does a marvelous job in this film.
Well, and I think you're right. I mean, it's interesting because this is, in the last 30 minutes, she goes through a transformation and becomes a different, not a different character, because she always was this, but it's like she comes through a physical transformation. And part of that is merely the transformation of leaving the order and taking off the nun's habit. But also, like, one of the things that I love, and it's really subtle in terms of thinking about her transformation, and this feels makes her even feel more like femme fatale, at least visually, is like you see her put on that sort of maroon red dress and the lipstick, like she's putting on a new identity there. But then at the scene at the very end, when she walks out while Sister Clodagh is ringing the bell, and she, for some reason, she's soaking wet. So it makes her hair, it's like her hair has now gone black because of that. And it's like a further transformation, like to the point where one of the first images I saw of this when I was looking for articles was the image you see of her in the doorway as she comes out. And my first thought was, well, that's not the same person because that's a brunette. But it's like she has gone through this deep transfer. I love that stuff.
At that point, she actually looks like a vampire. When she comes out that door, no, it's amazing. And Powell, Powell kind of pushed her into a more exterior melodramatic performance than she initially wanted to portray. But obviously, that was the right way to go. And I think she is interior earlier in the film. You feel this smoldering sense of her, and it's been set up by the Mother Superior. She's problematic. So I just they do it. She's a great slow burn as a character as she moves to that climax.
Yeah, no, and that's just it. That's what I like about it is it's not, there's nothing surprising about that change that you're told from almost the very beginning. I think what the sister says is, I mean, they talk about her being sick, and then the mother superior says something like she desperately wants to be seen as important or something, and it's like that's a haunting thing to say about somebody, in a kind of way.
And of course, at her first opportunity to be important, when she comes in with the blood on her habit, Sister Clodagh dismisses her, of course. And she gets positive reinforcement from Dean, and so that just kind of sets things up for us.
I hadn't thought of this until you brought up that scene, but like, she has some of the great scene entrances in this movie. Like, to come in a white nun's habit covered in blood is like a great, I mean, there's a lot of great images of her walking into a room and saying, "Now we have to deal with this," and you don't know what you're going to find.
She changes the temperature of the room every time she walks in. And I mean, to me, you know, one of the many things we could talk about with this film, obviously, is, you know, how do you deal with the inevitable differences among personalities in a community, right? And there's always going to be somebody who is in one way or another problematic, and it's going to be some kind of a catalyst for some kind of communal crisis. And that's exactly the role that she plays, because how communities deal with those potentially marginalized or actually marginalized members says a lot about the health of the community. And you can think a little bit about how going off to the castle where they did made the community less able to deal with Sister Ruth than they were when they were in Calcutta. And it also makes you wonder about Mother Superior and picking Sister Ruth to go with them. It's like, that's one way to deal with that problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a way to get rid of a problem in your own community. It's also a way to tank a mission she doesn't necessarily feel like. I mean, you get the impression she doesn't think Clota's up to this. She basically tells her that at the beginning of the movie. So it's this kind of doomed mission to begin with. But what's interesting is, how many times do you see a movie where you see somebody set off on a doomed mission and you realize, oh, this movie is about how they overcome that, and it's just like, nope, this one's spiraling. We're not going to get it. It's basically doomed from the jump. We never get to see this mission working well. Like, it's almost from the very beginning, there are problems.
Yeah, well, yeah, briefly, you know, they are coming to the clinic, they are coming to class, but it's very...
Because they're being paid.
Yeah, exactly. And they barely make it to Mr. Dean's prediction of, you won't last till the rains break, right? They just barely make that. So.
Yes. So another set of movies that this made me think of, and I almost want to ask you why. I think I know why, but like, if you had told me just some of the thematic things, and especially probably the last third of this movie, if you had told me this was a Hitchcock movie, I'd have been like, yeah, that feels about right. Like, there's something that reminds me of some of the kind of 50s Hitchcock movies. Again, I think it's part of the like psychological drama of this, and the and I think the kind of set piece at the end at the bell, like, that feels like this, it feels like a dramatic Hitchcock set piece, you know, when she's hanging from the rope and the way the music swells, there's something that feels like an echo. And I guess I'm not familiar enough with Hitchcock to point exactly to it, but I felt a little bit of that. This, again, feels like it would make sense alongside some of those 50s Hitchcock movies.
I can help you out, Sam. It's the ending of Vertigo.
Yes, absolutely.
And I actually found an article that does a more detailed comparison between that. And of course, Powell and Hitchcock were friends. You may recall that Hitchcock had recommended Kim Hunter to him for a Matter of Life and Death. And then Jack Cardiff, the cinematographer for Black Narcissus, ends up as cinematographer for Hitchcock in Under Capricorn. So the two definitely have a close relationship.
Absolutely. So, which makes me think about like a question I haven't asked you in a long time, but when you think about this movie, if you had to put it within like what genres is this, would you put this movie in? Cause like, I came up with like maybe four that I would say, well, it kind of fits within this genre or subgenre. And it's, and you hear different ways it's talked about, like, it's definitely a psychological drama as a, you know, as a subgenre. I think even the Wikipedia page, that's the leading line. As the movie goes on, it definitely takes on sort of a thriller type feel in the last 30 minutes. It almost becomes a horror movie. Once Ruth goes through her change, there is this, she almost seems possessed in a kind of way. And the way it's shot, the way she shot, like, kind of in the background or stalking Clota at the end, has some horror elements to it. And then reading both Scorsese and Powell talk about this movie, The word that comes up, which is a very strange word if you're thinking about a 1947 movie about nuns, is erotic.
Erotic.
Like an erotic film. Yeah. So when you think about this genre-wise, like what do you think about that?
Yeah, Powell said the most erotic film I ever made. I don't know if it's a genre, Sam, but I think of nun films. Or maybe what I should say is, maybe a better way to think about this is religious mission films. So I think specifically about The Mission, you know, with Robert De Niro. I think about a really interesting Bruce Beresford film called Black Robe. Maybe Bells of St. Mary's, although I haven't seen that in years. So I think you know, it kind of goes back to what you said earlier about, you know, people kind of going off on a quest, or people going off to accomplish an impossible mission, pulling it off. It sort of belongs to that genre, but kind of married to, you know, this is a religious mission, or this is a little bit maybe like The Razor's Edge, you know, somebody going off into a remote area to kind of find himself or find themselves. And then, oddly enough, if I were pairing it, I might pair it with The Man Who Would Be King, as also sort of a mission, although not a religious mission, and also kind of an adventure film. So those are some of the ways I might align it with other films.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has it's living in colonial space, and right on the verge of post-colonial questions. And as you said, historically, this comes a year before Indian independence. So it's definitely speaking to its moment, but also I think has echoes that make it meaningful well beyond the specifics of that moment.
But you're right. You know, if somebody were to say to me, what kind of film are you going to show me? I want to show you Black Narcissus. What kind of film are you going to show me? I would say, I'm going to show you the greatest Technicolor film ever made.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
that's the genre.
It is formally so interesting to look at. I mean, I think I wrote in my notes as I was watching it, like, as much as I loved the use of color in A Matter of Life and Death, I'm like, is this the best looking color film or Technicolor film that I can imagine? I think I use the I use the phrase oil painting in a couple to talk about a couple scenes, but this one is even more so. There's the compositions, the way that they use so much dark in this alongside the Technicolor is, I mean, this looks like you're watching, you know, a great Dutch master's paintings or something. Like, there's just something weighty about the color too, and rich and dense about the color, where I do think A Matter of Life and Death, I last week I said it's somewhere between oil painting and watercolor. This doesn't have the watercolor to it. This feels really oil painting to me.
Well, what's really interesting to me is that sometimes when people think about one of the advantages of black and white photography, they often talk about the use of shadow. And so it's amazing to me that in a color medium that Cardiff was able to accomplish what he did, what does with shadows and darkness. And, you know, as you just alluded to, Vermeer was kind of one of his models as he thought about how to use light. There's that wonderful extra on the Criterion Channel, right, where he goes into the museum and actually looks at Vermeer lighting. The other artist, I think, who's here, I'm not sure if this is talked about in that documentary, but is Caravaggio, who's the other great, you know, artist of chiaroscuro. And you see that in this film as well. So I think that's the other way. It's not just a great film in terms of color. It's a great film in terms of lighting as well.
Well, to the point where it was so innovative that when this went to the Technicolor processing, they went back to Cardiff and said, you ruined these shots. This can't be what you want. And he was like, no, that's exactly what I want. Because he was pushing that young medium in directions that the people in charge of it weren't comfortable with and weren't aware was possible, right? And they come out with some pretty amazing things.
Yeah, you know, Powell was a bit of a rebel. Powell liked to push the envelope a little bit. And so, I think Cardiff says it was, you know, the greatest gift of his life to be able to work on this film, because Powell really allowed him to do all those things. And I think one of the reasons he was able to win the arguments with Technicolor is because Cardiff was a recognized master of Technicolor. As we talked about last week, he'd been trained by the Technicolor people, and he knew how to handle Technicolor. So if when they say this is a mistake and he comes back and says, no, it's not, here's what I was trying to do, they actually believe him as a result. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I want to go back to this, to Scorsese and Powell's comments about the sort of eroticism of this film, because I want to dig into that a little bit, because that's what Powell is saying about it. So as you mentioned, You know, he says it's the most erotic film that that Powell ever made. He says it's all done by suggestion, but there's eroticism in every frame and image from the beginning to the end. It's a film full of wonderful performers and passion just below the surface, which finally at the end of the film erupts. and I think it's interesting because, like, at first glance, that's not the thing that jumped out at me. But when I watched it a second time, in light of thinking about some of the things that Powell and Scorsese said, I paid attention to how much of the story of this movie is not spoken. But mm-hmm. like you're paying attention. Like, this is a movie in huge ways about people's eyes. Like it's like you're having a conversation, and then there's all the things they're not saying with body language, and particularly with people's eyes. There's a lot of you know, especially looks between Clota and Dean, looks that Ruth is giving on the edges of a scene, or a cutaway to her responding to something or watching something. Even Sister Philippa, who's I want to get into later, who's one of my favorite characters, like there's something about the vacant stares that she gives, you know, as she's out working, which point to maybe edges of this story that we don't even get to get into, but we're aware that she is also being affected by this place.
Yeah, you know, because Sister Clota is one of the main characters, we get her backstory, so we know exactly what's behind her thinking. And so I think what we do is then we fill in for the others. You know, we say, well, they've got some kind of a similar backstory that they're returning to, and hers kind of becomes the kind of the template for whatever those other stories are. But you know, the essence of eroticism, I think, is you know, sometimes people think eroticism, you know, is about, you know, explicit passion, but it's really about a desire. You know, what is erotic is intended to increase or inflame desire. And that's sort of what this film is about. Like, what is it that people are doing? What have they committed themselves to, or attempted to commit themselves to? And what is it that they either desire or are trying no longer to desire or have desired in the past? So it's very, you know, it's very internal, but at the same time, that drama is externalized in terms of those gorgeous surroundings. So that's why I think the flowers and take on an erotic quality, because they're mm-hmm. expressing what the characters are holding inside themselves.
And those flowers are pointing to the fact that this is at the core of nature, right? Right. I mean, like flowers are the sexual organs of those plants, yes, right? Like, so it is, yeah, it, you know, and you see the nuns, when you see Sister Philippa planting flowers instead of planting food, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, okay, well, that's if you're paying attention, that's an interesting symbol to think about, right? And at the end, before she leaves, I think she's the one who brings flowers to the cross and puts it, you know, yes. puts them right below the cross, right? So like, that's, if the movies invited you to think about flowers as this natural image of reproduction, that's a pretty interesting symbol to bring to the cross.
I also have to say, Sam, that moment when you realize what she's planted, I feel like we're kind of back in the thriller genre. It's like, oh my gosh, this person's actually crazy. This mm-hmm. person's actually insane. And it's actually kind of a scary moment. You know, she's reading off, you know, I mean, it's just an interesting moment, because it could go comical. You know, we don't have potatoes, we have peonies or whatever it is. But I think as the list goes on, it gets a little scarier. This is kind of like, well, what is going on in her mind? What is happening here? And that's what I really love about the film, is that it's subtle. You know, it's not as though everything simply falls apart in a dramatic way. It's like you realize it's this slow accretion of small things going wrong that then have these larger implications. And it's one of those films, to get another theme that I like with our conversations, it's another film that treats the viewer as an intelligent person who's actually going to be thinking about what's going on the screen and what's not being shown but is being implied.
Absolutely. One of my favorite scenes in this movie, kind of speaking about these subtleties, is when it's after Christmas, when Clota calls Ruth in, and they're sitting in her office, and Clota is talking about Mr. Dean, and it's at the exact moment when she says, like, I think you think too fondly of Mr. Dean. And the way that is shot is, you are almost like in the eyes of Clota. It's very Clota POV shot, and the but mm-hmm. it's her holding a pencil,
yes.
and you're seeing it from her perspective, and it's and she's kind of turning it in her hands, and you can almost see her like trying to press all of her emotion and mm-hmm. energy into that object, like it is an object of repression, and then the camera doesn't cut; it just pans up to Ruth. And Ruth, kind of with red-rimmed eyes, is just staring deeply, you know, daggers into Clota. And it's clear, because from her POV, we're looking at that pencil, we realize, oh, Clota is avoiding eye contact, and Ruth has unbroken eye contact at that moment. And it's like, that is such a great, it's a really quick shot, but it's like, that is a perfect way, sort of cinematically, to talk about these two characters and how Clota is trying desperately to hold these things in, and Ruth is starting to like that's if we weren't sure yet, Ruth, this is the moment where we're aware Ruth is starting to erupt, because this is where she starts to get dramatic and she starts yelling at Clota and things like this. Like, I loved that moment in this movie.
And this is also the moment when you really fully understand that they are in fact alter egos, and that in Clota dealing with Ruth is Clota dealing with herself, and it's Ruth in many ways who is, here's the other thing that can disrupt a community, right? Ruth is a truth teller. And the things that Ruth says about our sister Clota and Mr. Dean, in fact, are home truths and truths that Ruth doesn't, that Clota doesn't want to recognize about herself. You also said something very quickly in passing, Sam, I think it's interesting as well about this film, if I were looking at it again more closely, is the length that shots are held. That shot we talked about earlier when Sister Ruth comes out the door. I mean, it's not a long shot. It's like, there's a part of you who says, I wish he'd held it longer, but that's how the film has a kind of visual eroticism for the audience, because he's got these great shots. And sometimes you say, oh, I wish this shot could go on longer. And it kind of gives you this hunger that kind of propels you along. So I just think that's another way in which the film is so beautifully edited in terms of the length of those shots.
I want to go back to something you said when you were talking about how you realize in this moment that Ruth and Clota are alter egos, and like what Ruth is saying or projecting on the outside is the thing that's inside of Ruth. That's what I love about Philippa's story. Mm. When Philippa finally talks about what's happening, mm-hmm. she is describing exactly what we've seen Clota do.
Yes.
Like, she's like, oh, I've been here. As I'm here, this has awakened memories of things that drove me to the order, things that I had forgotten and wanted to forget. And now I can't stop. And it's just like, for one thing, you realize like, oh, what we've seen happening to Clota is also happening to Philippa. But we also see Philippa basically diagnosing Clota and saying like, I'm telling you what's happening. I don't even know that that's what's happening to you, but I'm telling you out loud, this is what's happening to you. And I love that this then points to all of them having these kinds of breaks to different degrees, right? That, and it's going to, you know, they're going to respond to that in some different ways. I mean, one of the other great moments in this movie is right before we get the sort of Ruth transformation. On the way to that scene, you see Clota walking through at night the convent, and she walks by each person's door, and we get to hear how each person is responding to what's happening. So you hear, I think the first person, I'm guessing who they are based on what we know about the characters, you hear a person praying, and I think that's Philippa. You hear somebody crying, and I think that's Sister Honey. You hear somebody snoring, which I presume is Bryony. She also looks like somebody who would snore. Speaking as a snorer, I can see other snores. And then we get to Ruth, and then it's like full on psychological break. And so it's like you, as you're walking through, it's like this movie is telling you we could open any of these doors, and there is something that we would need to deal with. But Ruth is the door the movie's going to open, and we're going to deal with that one. I love that.
And I'm glad you said that too, Sam, because I think another indication of a, I don't know if you want to say unhealthy, dysfunctional family or community is the inability to deal openly with problems or conflict. So there's never a meeting, right? Sister Clota never pulls everybody together and says, you know, we got a problem here. Let's talk about it. That never happens. And it's partly because she is unable to, unwilling to confront. And of course, the order has been doing this all along. I mean, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but you get back to the fact that, you know, the Mother Superior sent Sister Ruth away. I'm not sure that there's a model for dealing in a healthy way with problems within the community. And so usually what communities do that don't know how to deal with those problems is either they find a way to kind of marginalize or even excommunicate the difficult member, or they just go on pretending that the problem doesn't exist. So it's also, you know, the relocation of the castle is that kind of classic idea, right? That you can move your location, but you're going to bring your problems with you, which is what they do.
Okay, I want to ask a question that seems kind of maybe even a silly question, because there's large degrees to which this is obvious, but there's a character we haven't talked about yet that we need to get into. What do you make of what Dean represents in this movie? I mean, some of it is again comically obvious what he represents, but I want to talk about this because as I watched this again, I just had lots of thoughts and questions around this character. So when you think of the role that Dean plays and what he represents, what would you say to that?
Well, first of all, you know, we'll touch on the obvious. He's almost always got bare legs, and often he has a bare chest, right? And so he is, except when he shows up for Christmas drunk. So obviously he's virility, he's masculinity, he's sexuality, he's that stuff. He's also the classic British colonial in India, you know, who has the relationship with the general. He's also, to a certain degree, the voice of reason. I mean, we may not like, you know, Sister Clodagh, the others don't want to admit that, but in fact, he has a very clear understanding of the situation. He's a little bit that colonial voice. He's got that kind of condescension towards the natives, but he also becomes a kind of an opportunity for these different worldviews to be contrasted with each other. So when he says to Sister Clodagh towards the beginning, the people are like children, Sister Clodagh says, without discipline, we would all behave like children. So he kind of represents a sensuality that Sister Clodagh and maybe the others are kind of trying to repress. Somebody says towards the end, I think it might be Sister Philippa, but I might be getting that wrong. Somebody says there's only two ways of living in this place, like Mr. Dean or the Holy Man. Ignore it or open yourself up to it. So, okay, you know, so, and the sisters are trying to live in that between space, between the Holy Man and between Mr. Dean. It can't be done, is what the film suggests.
Yes, that is Sister Philippa, because I think that's also an interesting moment of kind of statement in this film that maybe we can circle back to that as we're thinking about the Holy Man as well. I think Dean is also interesting because he is a character that people also project things onto. I mean, I love the moment when Ruth goes down to his place at the end and she's like, you're the only one who's ever been nice to me and I love you. And he's like, I've barely said a word to you. Like she is taking small things and projecting big things onto it. And it makes me also wonder, because Clodagh clearly has tons of thoughts about Dean and she has a lot more experience with him. But I also wonder how much she is also, like Ruth, projecting things onto him. Because I think about, like, what do we actually see him do in this movie? Because she's very, very much doesn't want him there, doesn't want him involved, doesn't want him working on the plumbing. Like, there's this kind of tension there. So it's, you know, when I think about the things we see him do, we see him fixing the plumbing. I think the way he dresses just, and maybe this is just 2024 eyes, it just looks so funny because you see all these people. I mean, the nuns are all obviously very much, you know, in all kinds of layers. You see everybody else in clothes, and he'll walk in basically like only wearing a pair of short shorts. And it's like, would you not feel uncomfortable being the only person? I mean, he is so clearly like a body in the same way the flowers represent that. He represents that. We see him helping them unpack. We see him bring Kanji to the convent, which is actually like, I mean, they're a little uneasy about that, but like, that seems like the exact type of person you would bring to the convent, yes. Right? Somebody who's like, this person's sort of a wild child and maybe she needs to learn to settle a little bit. So like that actually, I mean, he's introducing an element to their convent that they're concerned about, but in reality, like That's most religious convent stories are people like that. I mean, that's the beginning of the lives of saints are also that story.
Yeah, that's right. Know? That's right. But, you know, I think Sister Clodagh recognizes that the balance at that point is so precarious that, you know, bringing kanji in at that point could tip things the wrong way. And
yes.
It actually, it's interesting. It has doesn't really have consequences for the convent itself as much as for the little general. But I love that scene with Dean, because that's a scene you talked about, communication through the eyes, and there's this moment he says to her, he says to her, you know, do you have any questions you want to ask me? Mm-hmm. And it's quite, you know, it's quite clear what's going on, and you know, it's not said, but both of them know exactly what's happening. The other thing I want to say about Dean is there's a couple of other characters, there's a couple of non-religious characters who talk about Jesus. Little General says at one point he's very interested in Jesus Christ. And Dean says something, I can't remember what it is, but he says something that Sister Clodagh finds almost sacrilegious, like speaking too familiarly or casually.
I have the line for you. So he says,
he should be casual and as much a part of your life like daily bread.
Yes.
So he's telling her, and of course, that's, okay, Sam, there's so much packed in there, right? Because what he's actually telling her is, unless you can find a way to bring together your daily life and who you are, because at one point she says something like, we're all human, right? But there's a sense in which she doesn't want to be human. She can't be human and be religious at the same time. And he's telling her, you can't be religious and human unless you are religious and human at the same time. So I just think it's you know, one more thing he's actually the voice of some kind of spiritual insight despite everything else.
Yes, no, that was the next thing I was saying. Like he is critiquing their religious practice in some pretty great ways. And so there's another moment that I think that comes before that, and it's when Sister Clodagh is talking to the young general when he's talking about Jesus, and he said, well, Jesus was a man, and she said, well, he took the form of a man.
Yes, that's right.
So she is so there's sort of this denial of humanity in that, right? Of like the maybe animal part of humanity. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, he didn't, I mean, like that's almost that's, I mean, that's like borderline heresy, right? To be, yeah, like, well, not really a man. Like, you know, where the general is coming, little general's coming in. There's such a sincerity to him, and it's like there. Yeah, I love that moment, and then that where that echoes with Dean, because I think Dean really is has some pretty powerful critiques of their way of life and even their understanding of religion. Whether he's religious or not, he knows enough Christianity to know, like, maybe you've lost your way.
Yeah. And it's the little general who at one point asked that classic question, you know, what would Jesus do? And it's the little general that, you know, obviously there's an erotic attraction between him and Kanchi, but he also, I mean, he violates a lot of societal norms by marrying her. So it's the little general that kind of embodies a kind of self-sacrifice.
The other thing about Dean, and this maybe goes to what Philippa says about the two ways to survive here, is that Dean seems to have accepted life the way it is in India. Like, I feel like he's a colonial figure, but he also seems like he's a mm-hmm. an over it colonial figure. Like, yeah, he's not here to try to westernize them, where the sisters still are. Christianize, westernize, how do we bring some order to this, where Dean represents somebody who is basically just like accepted, this is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And the sooner you do that, the sooner you're actually going to get along here and maybe do some good but you need to stop trying to, I mean, so I feel like he's also speaking to British Empire a little bit there too, to that imperial, the late imperial project, and saying like, we're not going to change this. This actually is what it is.
Yeah. And he's avoided that kind of cliche of, you know, quote unquote going native, right? It's like you said, it's he's comfortable. So, and I think there's that one little scene right before he meets with Sister Ruth, where he's sitting kind of on a veranda smoking. He's got his monkey next to him. Mm-hmm. It's just clear that this is a life he's very comfortable with. And you're right, he's not interested in imposing the Western values on it. He's actually serving as the general's agent. So there's a sense in which he has, he's kind of gone native in the best possible way, I guess.
What do you think of Clodagh's, the flashbacks we see of Clodagh's? Again, I love the fact that Philippa at least seems to imply that she's living out her own movie that we're not watching. But she's definitely haunting enough. But we are seeing these flashbacks from Clodagh's perspective of her life. And what I found interesting is when this film ran into trouble with the in the U.S. with the Catholic National League of Decency, it's the flashback scenes that need to be cut.
Yeah,
which was fascinating to me because I'm like, well, there are other things that I could see them potentially having problems with, but that's the part that that made it, taking those out made it okay for them.
Yeah, I also read that, Sam, and I think what I would speculate about that is those scenes reinforce the idea that Sister Clodagh has not moved positively towards a genuine calling, but is actually trying to run away from something. So I think it reinforces that notion that her religion is a kind of repressed sexuality, or she's trying to escape from the world rather than actually kind of embracing the religious life as her calling. And even so you don't have those scenes, and then you have her saying at one point when she talks about coming into the religious life, says something about God working in mysterious ways. So I think it helps. I'm speculating, but I think it helps just to kind of reinforce the notion of a religious calling and not an escape from life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thinking of this as a movie about sort of the tensions between the colonizing culture and the local culture, made me start to put this movie in conversation with other things. I mean, I thought about some of the 1970s Australian movies we watched, mm-hmm. The Last Wave, Picnic at Hanging Rock, the two Peter Weir films, Walkabout has this as well. It's like, I think those would actually pair nicely too, because mm-hmm. there is this sense of Britain for a long time has been trying to impress a kind of Westernism here. And when we're starting to see that even when they can establish something that feels like that, there are all these other things bubbling up. I mean, there's this great image that the palace was initially a place for a harem, right? I mean, I think that's what they mean when they talk about the generals women. And there's all the paintings on the wall, which sort of speak to the past there. Even the Holy Man. Mm-hmm. When you first see him, I'm thinking, oh, well, this is some sort of, Hindu priest or something like this. And the general, or excuse me, the dean tells us his backstory, and we realize that the Holy Man actually was like the old general, who was like the young general, who, speaks English, speaks all these European languages, has a Western education. And at some point, This is what he moved to, right? That's the, and I think that goes to Philippa's thing about the two ways to survive here: either ignore it, like Dean does, or give yourself into it. And Dean points out that the old general, that the Holy Man worries the old general quite a bit, particularly when he's in the middle of his dinner or trying on a new frock coat from London. I suppose he feels he ought to go and do likewise, which is like the other sort of religious image here too, and like. So again, it's this sort of sense of like, are there cultural forces or even primal forces underneath all of this that like this colonial attempt to impose a kind of Western order on, we're seeing break apart and then actually impact the people trying to do it in some, psychological ways. I think Last Wave, I thought a lot about with this movie.
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting that the Holy Man becomes a kind of rebuke to everybody else. The Holy Man is a rebuke to the general because he thinks maybe I should be renouncing. He's kind of a rebuke to the order because they are not able to overcome the way in which the world and the memories are pulling at them. So and he's got that wonderful he has that wonderful location, kind of literally up above everybody else, and so he becomes a kind of an ideal, but a kind of an unattainable ideal. And then, and then there's a little bit of a sense of, he never speaks, he never does anything, he doesn't intervene, he's not involved, and so is that an ideal? So he is a kind of ideal, but at the same time, there's a kind of a critique of that ideal as well.
Yeah. I love when they're looking for Ruth and they go up there with Joseph and they're like, you need to ask him if he saw Ruth. And he's like, if he did, it wouldn't have mattered to him at all. Like, it's like, like he's got nothing to tell you. The other movie that I thought a lot about with this, I thought a lot about The Shining with this movie as well. Again, you have this remote location, right? This people go to that has these echoes of a past and a colonial past, right? Because The Shining, the Overlook is built on on a different kind of Indian, Native American burial ground, right? Yeah. And like, and the sort of echoes of the past start to haunt people in different ways and bring things out of people. I'll just throw a couple other Shining things in there that I was thinking about. So people start to go even homicidally crazy, right? Ruth has a Jack Torrance-esque break. One of the things that Jack Torrance talks about in The Shining is the importance of doing his work. Think of how often they talk about, we are an order that does work. Work is the answer to how do we deal with these psychological things going on? Sister Ruth gives a full-on Kubrick stare in this movie. I mean, there's a shot that like you could line up with Private Pyle and Jack Torrance, and it's like Kubrick stare. Even Angu Aya, when she's introduced, there is a sentence that sounds very much like The Shining. Angu Aya, who's always been there and stays on as caretaker. Okay. And then the next line is, she lives alone with the ghosts of bygone days. I mean, so like this, it's not The Shining, but it's like, wow, those two would be that would be an interesting set of movies to look at together.
Sam, that is brilliant. I love that. I think you got a little article there. That's really fantastic. I would love to sit through that double bill. That would be a fun time.
So then we haven't really talked about the characters that are actually from India in this movie. I love Joseph. It's one of those moments when they find a child performer and it's like this person is perfect for this. Yeah. I love in his introduction, he describes his age between 6 and 11, which also, again, I think speaks to sort of Western notions of time and things like this. And his answer is so strange. He's like, I remember that I'm 6. Like, I know I can remember 6 years and I know how long my parents have been married. So therefore, I am somewhere between the ages I remember and when they met. And it's like, that is a different way to think about time. And it's interesting watching him teach, like the way he teaches the lesson on the war machines. I'm thinking, like, what are they teaching these children? He's like, battleship, cannon. And I'm like, and it makes you wonder, like, what is this school? And it also maybe because Ruth is the one who's supposed to be overseeing that, is like, how uninvolved is Ruth in her teaching that this is what, because he's basically just teaching those children, right? You don't really see Ruth doing that. And then after the baby's death, he is no longer able to move between the two worlds, right? There's the sense of like, if he go, they'll allow him to go back, but he can never go back to the palace then. And then we get Kanchi, which is I was nervous about this in this movie, and I think there's only two characters that are explicit brown face characters. And then the old general is one of them. And I think, you know, we already talked about how she sort of stands in contrast to the sister's virginity and those types of things. Like, and so she is a symbol of that, and then becomes obviously connected with the young general, seeking Western education. And he's the image of kind of ostentatious wealth in contrast with the sisters, the austerity of them. I mean, if you just think about, here's where color comes in as well. You think about the clothes that he wears, the colors he wears compared to like the oatmeal white of the sisters. Yeah. And here's where we get, and I was seeing a lot about this, the titular Black Narcissus perfume, right? So it seems significant that that's what this movie is called. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on this movie called Black Narcissus and the significance of the perfume?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting it's called Black Narcissus because we have this gorgeous color film and our attention is directed to the color black. So it's interesting when you hear the title of the film, you think it's a visual reference to a flower, but it's actually an olfactory reference to a smell. So I think they're kind of getting both senses involved. It truly was, it still is a perfume you can buy, and he gets it from London. So again, it's one of those kind of colonial things. But I think the most important thing about it is what he says about it. You know, Sister Ruth doesn't like, well, she says she doesn't like it, but we mean in this film that means she likes it because it's very
Right.
tempting, right? And he says, "Don't you think it's rather common to smell of ourselves?" So it's another reference to the idea of, here I am, I'm a human being. How do I avoid being a human being? How do I transcend being a human being? How do I transform being a human being? So that most fundamental thing about being human, which is sweating and smelling, is something that we're going to kind of cover up and avoid being, quote, common. So I think in a way, his black narcissus is kind of his view, his way of coping with being human and somehow trying to overcome that. And later on, rather than black narcissus, it's his kind of condescension, if you will, in marrying Kanchi that actually enables him to kind of transcend himself.
Okay, here's my thought on this, and I'm probably wrong, but this is what I was thinking. So I think about the perfume as it can serve as a symbol of kind of exotic sexuality, which is bubbling beneath this movie, right?
Right.
But the movie where there and I think the Englishness, the colonial nature of this movie has this sense that, like, well, the Indian people have this. And I'm gonna all this is in heavy quotes what I'm saying, have this more like primal animalistic sexuality, and that the Westerners are coming to kind of put that in check, right? That's sometimes a colonial project, right? But the idea is that actually the symbol of exotic sexuality comes from London and is brought. So there is this sense of like, actually, are the Westerners bringing that? Are they bringing those notions there as well? In the same way. And here's another place where I'm probably wrong. We hear the Ballad of the Prince and the Beggar Maid, which is, if I read about this, you probably know more about this, but it this seems to be a an English story about like African exoticism, right? Like it's about this African king or African prince, but it's an English story, and then it's imposed onto the experience of and maybe even shapes the experience of the young general. So again, it's this weird moving between maybe Western views of otherness then brought and imposed on. I thought about that with both the perfume and the story. Again, I could be wrong there, but I feel like there's maybe something to that.
Yeah, I actually, Sam, I kind of like thinking about it that way. I think that, the idea that it takes the Western influence to wonder if maybe I shouldn't be smelling of myself, right? So yeah, I can go with that.
We also see the young general when he's talking to Clodagh at the end say, I'm going to give up being clever and famous. I'm going to be exactly like my ancestors. They were warriors and princes. They were modest, brave, and polite, and they never did anything cheating. So in that sentence, we get two potential value, different sets of values. Presumably, the clever and famous is the thing that he that maybe the is the Western value put onto him because he says, I want to be more like my ancestors. But then I listen to both of those and think, are those just two different bills of goods he's been sold about like who he's supposed to be? So I'm not going to be the because he's just sort of jumping around. And Clodagh references this at the very end of the film, right? Where she's like, I can't just change by the minute like the young general. Like, so I feel for him at the end of this movie that it's like, I'm not sure the path that he has chosen is ultimately the right path either.
It doesn't seem to represent the same stability you get with either the Holy Man or Mr. Dean, for sure.
We've already talked about the Ruth break a little bit and the scene with the bells. Is there anything else you want to talk about there before we get to the actual last scene of the film?
No, go right ahead.
Okay, so the last scene of the film, we see the sisters leaving. We have this final conversation between Clodagh and Dean. We learn that Clodagh is essentially being demoted, that she's going to be sent to a different convent where she will be stripped of her leadership. Then she says, it's what I need. I can't change by the minute like the young general, but I shall have my ghosts to remind me. And Dean says, you're leaving me leaving me with more than one ghost as well, right? So there is this sense of this experience has happened, and it's sort of affected everyone. It's left them haunting. And then this is where, you know, this makes me think of Aya with the Ghosts of Bygone Days, right? That this is a movie about haunting to that degree as well.
Yeah. And and one of the things she says at the end is, I couldn't stop the wind from blowing and the air being as clear as crystal. And that connects to me to the comment that Sister Philippa makes earlier when she's beginning to discuss her problems with Sister Clodagh. And she says, I think you can see too far. And that, and that's the point at which she's urged to work hard. So there's a sense that it is that milieu that causes them to see. It's not just the temptation of the world, but it's a sense that suddenly you can see that life is much larger and more complicated than the way you're trying to restrict it, or the way you're trying to stuff it into a manageable form.
Mm-hmm. And then the final request that Clodagh makes is that Dean watches, cares for Ruth's grave. And yes. What I found interesting about this is the origins of this story is that Rumor Godden, who had grown up in India, once she and some friends were out in the woods or in the jungle, and they found a grave that just said Sister Ruth.
Yes, that's right.
And then I presumably this story is the, I wonder what that story could be. And this story grows out of that.
Well, there's a connection back to Let Matter of Life and Death, because Emmerich Pressburger read about an airman that fell out of an airplane without a parachute and survived. And so that was the kernel of that film.
Yes. So then we get the rains that come, right? And we get reminded of the, I give you till the rains break. And we get at first this sort of dripping, slow dripping, and then in this sort of explosion of rain. And whenever I see rain in anything, I think of The Wasteland and like what is the potential meaning of rain to the kind of spiritual meaning of rain. And apparently Powell had, there was a scene after this where Clodagh goes and talks with the Mother Superior that was filmed. Cardiff says it's the best thing he's ever shot. And Powell saw the rain scene and was like, nope, there's my ending. So that scene is entirely lost. Like there is no remnants of that. But it's a pretty powerful ending, right? To watch them leave. And I imagine watching this as a British person in 1947, as India, there's this sense that the empire is collapsing, and there's a sense of England leaving India, right? You see them leaving the mountain at the same time. And I think it causes you to reflect on those projects.
Well, you know, it's a sign of a great artist who knows what to take out as well as what to leave in. And it takes a tremendous amount of discipline to do that. And so, I mean, I just can't imagine how Carter felt, but he did end it exactly right. A coda at that point would have been the wrong move. So,
Do you have anything else you want to talk about with this movie?
Yeah, there's one really obvious thing we haven't talked about, Sam, which kind of connects to this. And that is that people are sometimes shocked to discover this is not a shot on location.
Yes, yes, yes.
Everything is, it's studio. They did go to a garden in England that had been planted with all these Indian plants. So that is an exterior. Otherwise, everything else, there's the overhead shots of the castle when it's first approaching, that's a model. And then they built this amazing set, and all the exteriors, all the view from the castle, those are all matte paintings by somebody named a painter named Peter Ellenshaw. And people, there's great stories about people watching this film and say, "Oh, I've been to India. I know exactly where that is. I've been to Mopu. I've seen that." So appropriately enough, the film won both two Academy Awards. Academy Award for the cinematography. Obviously, in those days, they had color versus black and white color cinematography, and the set design. The set designer was a great, great German set designer named Alfred Junge. And I want to point out that there's a deep, deep irony about the fact that it was filmed this way, because this is a film about the limits of control. What happens when you try to control your environment, control your life, and yet the film and the film is made very conscientiously and assiduously within control, because what Powell said was, it's if we do some location shooting and some studio shooting, we're never going to get a uniform look. And he also knew the danger of shooting remotely and having the film come back and not in some ways be damaged or whatever. So I just think that, to me, that's If you watch this film with somebody and then you say at the end, you know, they never went to India, those mountains that none of that exists, to me that kind of redoubles the craft of this film. It's so incredibly well crafted.
And who did that make you think of? A filmmaker who will shoot things all at home.
Oh man, you know, this is Stanley Kubrick saying I can do Vietnam without leaving.
Exactly. I thought about Full Metal Jacket. I think, yeah. So like that's exactly what I thought of when I saw it. Yeah, the film looks amazing. There's a great, anybody listening to this, if you go to the Wikipedia page for this, you'll see a shot of the bell tower, both with the matte painting and without it. And you realize like, it's like a 6-foot drop, you know, but what they have on the set, but then they put this cliff underneath it and it looks really amazing. So Barrett, what do you have for us for next week?
Well, this is kind of an unusual choice. I think it may not be a film you've heard of, Sam. But I think, you know, I'm kind of interested in Deborah Carr as a nun. So the next film that Deborah Carr does as a nun with one of my favorite Hollywood actors, Robert Mitchum, is a John Huston film called Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, from 1957. It's another World War II film. This is a location shoot, and that's all I'll tell you.
Well, you have successfully picked something I have never heard of. So very excited for this. Barrett, thank you so much for recommending this film and for having this conversation. I think this is such an interesting, rich text to dig into. So thank you for that. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back next week to talk about Heaven Knows Mr. Allison in the video store.